Hutchison and Center is their home church. So let's bow our heads for a word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, we come before you again this evening. We just pray that your presence would be felt here again this evening. Guide and direct Daryl in his thoughts and his presentation, and also help our hearts to understand and be able to understand the times that we live in through the lens of the history that we are looking at tonight. We pray this all in the precious name of Jesus. Amen. Blessings.
Thank you. Give me a moment and I'll see if I can figure out what has occurred here. Do I need to push Windows K again? It had been connected earlier. Okay. Okay, that might be getting us where we need to be. Thank you. Sorry about that. I had it connected earlier and it decided to disconnect me. So, good evening. It's good to be with you again. So on November 27 of 1095, a richly dressed man stood in front of a large group of nobles and clergy, and his opening words were, "Most beloved brethren, urged by necessity, I, Urban, by the permission of God, chief bishop and prelate over the whole world, have come into these parts as an ambassador with a divine admonition to you, the servants of God." And we'll skip ahead to another part of his address where he says, "You must apply the strength of your righteousness to another matter which concerns you as well as God. For your brethren who live in the East are in urgent need of your help, and you must hasten to give them the aid which has been promised them. For as the most of you have heard, the Turks and Arabs have attacked them and have conquered the territory of Romania." Think of that as the Byzantine Empire. "As far west as the shore of the Mediterranean, the Hellespont, which is called the Arm of St. George. On this account, I, or rather the Lord, beseech you as Christ's heralds to publish this everywhere and to persuade all people of whatever rank, foot soldiers and knights, poor and rich, to carry aid promptly to those Christians and to destroy that vile race from the lands of our friends. I say this to those who are present. I meant also for those who are absent. Moreover, Christ commands it. Let those who have been serving as mercenaries for small pay now obtain the eternal reward. Let those who have been wearing themselves out in both body and soul now work for double honor. Behold, on this side will be the sorrowful and the poor, and on that the rich. On this side the enemies of the Lord, and on that his friends. Let those who go not put off the journey, but rent their lands and collect money for their expenses. As soon as winter is over and spring comes, let him eagerly set out on the way with God as their guide." So, thus began one of the most sad periods in church history, and that is the Crusades. This address by Pope Urban I at the Council of Clermont set off an enormous wave of adventurers from Europe out to save the Holy Land from the Islam, from the infidels or the Muslims. So we're going to need to, of course, back up a bit, like we always do. I do want to tell the story of the Crusades, but I'm only going to be able to tell you a couple of them because it's a big story. There are, depending on how you count it, some people say there are 7 Crusades, others say there are 12, and still others say the Crusades continued on up even past the discovery of the Americas. So it all depends on your creativity as a historian, I suppose. But we're just going to look at about 3 of them, and we'll look at them briefly. But before we can get there, we first have to understand, well, what happened to make the Crusades seem something that would be necessary? So we left the story of Byzantium and the Umayyad Caliphate at kind of loggerheads, but the Byzantine Greek fire had kind of lifted the siege of Constantinople, and it felt like they had gotten some breathing room. Well, they did continue to have breathing room, actually. The Umayyad Caliphal dynasty kind of dies out in 150 years or so, and a new dynasty arises called the Abbasids, and they're based at a different place. They're based in Baghdad and farther east. And they preside over what we know of as the Islamic Golden Age. It's a time of great flowering of sciences and knowledge and trade in the Islamic world, especially in the part of the world probably we would know best as Iraq and Iran and Syria, Egypt, that part of the world, Saudi Arabia. And they stopped fighting as aggressively against the Christians. There was still tension there, but it started becoming more of a cold war. We don't like them, they don't like us, but we're not going to go try to take some of their territory right now. However, the Abbasid Caliph started getting a little uneasy on his throne because he started having other people who became powerful in his empire, and he decided that he really needed some help. So at this time, just before the events I'm going to talk about, you can find, if you take a look here, this is the rough extent of the Byzantine Empire. Now, it's not as big as it once had been, but you can see that it includes a pretty good chunk of the lands of the old Byzantine Empire. However, what's about to happen to it is completely unforeseen by it. So if you'll look over here, you can see there's a pretty big gap between our last two pictures, the picture of Muhammad and the picture of the Crusades. That's a pretty long period of time, and during that period of time, the political stability of the Byzantine Empire had kind of led to a bit of a golden age for Islam, too. I'm sorry, for Byzantine, too, Byzantium, I should say, as well. And then along comes the Caliph here in Baghdad, and he's worried about other people in his, other Muslims in his empire, and so he starts to hire people to come down out of this land up here. Now, remember I talked about the lands up there as being inhabited by nomadic tribes. These tribes are loosely, you can imagine them as Plains Indians. They traveled a lot. Their dwellings were yurts, and they could easily be moved. They needed, the horse was central to their way of life. They had some of history's greatest bows. And kind of pound for pound, these warriors could not really be equaled anywhere. And they can travel fast and light. Their weapons, their bows are so powerful that they can actually shoot through armor. A conservative estimate says their bows may have been 90 pounds. I've heard the upper end being somewhere around a 160-pound pole. So let's just say somewhere between 90 and 160-pound pole, that is a very powerful bow. And if you marry that with a horse-born rider who has three or four horses and a large extra horse pool riding with him, you can imagine how these warriors would be very coveted. So the Caliph hires these guys out of the lands just north of him to come down and fight for him. These are mostly Turkic-speaking groups. And these guys, when they come to Baghdad and start fighting for the Caliph, they often convert. And after a little bit, they're kind of expected to convert. But it's a sort of conversion that leaves some of their original paganism intact. It's kind of a rough conversion. But eventually they get so numerous that they realize, oh, you know what? We can tell the Caliph what to do. Why do we need to wait for him to pay us? We'll just take the money we want. So suddenly, you had an entire group of, an entire tribal group of Turks under a powerful warlord who comes along and says, okay, Mr. Caliph, you're going to do what we tell you to, and there's nothing you can do about it. So the Caliph turns into a puppet government, and these Turks start looking for places to go. And of course, in the interior of Anatolia right here is a large plateau. It's fairly high elevation, about 3,000 feet of elevation, and it's a grasslands. It is perfect place for people who are used to these grassy steppes out here. It's a perfect place for them. And the other nice thing about it, from their perspective, is it is the Christians who own it. And so since they're recently converted Muslims, it's just fine for them to go in there and take that from the Byzantine Empire. So they started raiding. And what would typically happen is there would be summer raids through the mountains into the interior of Anatolia. And after a while, the emperor over here in Constantinople would get his army, and he would march over here, and he would try to fight them off. And sometimes he caught them, and there would be a battle. Sometimes he won, sometimes he lost. It wasn't usually a very big battle. These were raiding parties. But they started to increase in intensity. And after a while, the emperor realized, I've got to actually stop this. So he rounds up a large army. He marches over here. And at this place called Manzikert, this happens in 1071. 1071, he encounters a very large Turkic, we call them Seljuk Turks because of the warlord, Seljuk Turkic force drawn up for battle. So now you have Byzantine infantry and cavalry on one side, you have the kind of swirling bands of steppe warriors on the other side, and there's a kind of a tense moment. What's going to happen? Who's going to win? Well, it didn't take long. The Turkish forces kind of came charging in, looking like they were going to just slam into the column. And just before they got there, they stopped, turned around, and acted like they were running away. This is a very common tactic for mounted archers. And of course, as soon as they do that, the Byzantine forces want to quickly attack them while they're fleeing. And when they do that, they get all kind of strung out. Meanwhile, the warriors from the steppes are watching over their shoulders. As soon as they see that everybody is all strung out and vulnerable, they blow a signal on their trumpets and wave some flags, and the columns split, swirl around, and hit them from all sides. And suddenly it's a double envelopment, and nobody can go anywhere. And everywhere they look, it's dust and flying arrows and thudding hooves. And it's over fairly quickly, actually. The Byzantine army is completely completely routed. Some of them are captured and some are killed. And the emperor is captured. So this has not happened often, that an emperor of Constantinople is captured. And for sure not often that people from the steppe lands out here who are kind of considered uncultured and barbaric, they're the ones that capture the, you know, the leader of Christendom, the leader of Constantinople. Well, they actually don't kill the emperor. They let him go back, but he is so overcome by his failings as an emperor that he dies, presumably of a broken heart, according to the sources at the time, fairly quickly. Well, this Battle of Manzikert kind of opens the door because at this point, the Byzantine Empire no longer thinks they can hold this border anymore, and they start pulling their troops back to more defensible positions. In other words, they almost, in a manner, they stop defending this entire central Anatolian region. And they basically just concern themselves with hanging on to their fortifications along the coastline. So what happens in Anatolia is the center of it. For the record, Anatolia is this peninsula right here. That's the name of it. So Anatolia becomes, on the inside, in the steppe lands, or in the high plateau, central plateau, it becomes a Muslim Turkic, part of the Muslim Turkic Empire. And out on the coastlines, you have the Christian Byzantine cities that are fortified that, you know, can get supplies through via ship. And so that's how Anatolia finds itself more or less conquered by these Seljuk Turks. Now, the Turks are conquering other places as well. So they've got this pope, or I'm sorry, the caliph down here in Baghdad as a puppet. And they proceed to go on and conquer other parts of the Muslim Empire. And so it's called the Abbasid Caliphate still, but it's really Turkic soldiers who are controlling, and especially the sultans of the Seljuks. Alp Arslan is an important name from this period. You'll recognize him probably. So that is the problem that is facing the Byzantine Empire's emperors. What do we do about these Turks? How do we stop them? And they just keep out fighting them every chance they get. So along about 1095, emperor by the name of Alex Komnenos asked the Pope, could you please send me some knights? I need some help. Now, understand that what had happened just before in Christendom is kind of clouding the picture as well. So we need to set that up. What's happening in Christendom is the Pope over here in Rome and the Patriarch of Constantinople in 1054. Those two guys had mutually excommunicated the other guy. So the representatives of the Pope walked into the great church of Hagia Sophia, the kind of the heart of Constantinopolitan, something, the heart of Christianity in Constantinople, let's say it that way. And on the altar, he slaps down this papal bull, and it says the patriarch is no longer in communication with the Pope. He has been excommunicated. And the priest begged him, please take this thing back. No, you don't want to do this. You don't want to tear Christianity apart like this. And the Pope's representatives just turned around and walked out. And it's not long before the Patriarch sends a letter of excommunication to the Pope. And now neither of these two major churchmen see the other as part of their church. So this is called the Great Schism. And it basically kind of, think of it as bringing a divide kind of east to west in the church. Well, it's not quite as simple as that, but that's a rough starting point to think of. So with this schism, when Alex Komnenos, the emperor, says, hey, Pope, would you send us some guys? The Pope says, you know what? I may be able to heal this breach of the church. If I would send him some serious aid, maybe that will bring the Patriarch of Constantinople to his senses, and he'll recognize that he should repent and come back into communion with the Roman Catholic Pope. And so then maybe I would gain control of, you know, the entire church, east and west. At least that's what we think he was probably thinking. And so when he stood up, like I read at the beginning, when he stood up and made his speech at Clermont, what he was trying to do was get a huge movement of people to go over and help with these wild Turks that nobody can control, no Christian at least. And what he got probably surprised even him. He got a mass migration of people from Europe to the Holy Lands. So I'm going to talk about the First Crusade, and I'm going to talk about the Third Crusade, and then the Fourth Crusade. So First, Third, and Fourth. I'll try to, you know, spend as much time as I need to on them, but the First Crusade is going to take more time than the others because it's more important. So the First Crusade has kind of two pieces to it. The first thing that happened after this speech is a guy by the name of Peter the Hermit got up and started preaching that people ought to head down to Constantinople and defend it from the, you know, the Muslims. So what first movement of people was called the People's Crusade, and it was just townspeople. These were not nobles. These were not people with any kind of experience in soldiering. They just kind of packed up and headed out. Let's go find those Muslims and fight them. You know, they're the enemy of Christ. So the People's Crusade mostly is remembered for the violence it committed against Jews in the Rhineland. I'm going to jump over that one. So in this area, right here in the Rhineland, as these people started marching toward the Middle East, they kept encountering cities with large Jewish populations. The first thing they said was, why do we need to go all the way down to the Middle East to find heathens? We've got these Jews living here. And so they all set about attacking the Jews and destroying them. And the princes of these cities said, this is terrible. We don't want you doing that to our population. They didn't like it, but there were too many of them. So the People's Crusade is famous for its pogroms against the Jews, very anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic rhetoric. It was quite a violent kind of rabble. Eventually, it gets down to Constantinople, and Alex Komnenos looked at this group and said, what in the world did the Pope send me? This is not what I asked for. What Alex thought he was getting was, you know, a couple thousand well-armed knights. He thought if he could have some of those, that would work really nicely, and he could pay them, they'd go fight for him, you know, a controllable amount. But what he got was the rabble from Europe and a huge pile of them. So he quickly gets them sent across the Bosphorus over into Turkey, what's now modern Turkey, so Anatolia. And he was kind of just glad to see them go. And it's not long before the Seljuks out there, they catch on that there's a big group of Christians coming. Well, let's go see what we've got. And they scout them out and they say, this isn't a group of soldiers. This is, these are future slaves. And that's what they did. They quickly took them captive. The battle was quite insignificant. They easily routed them. A bunch were killed, but then also many were taken slaves and sold on the slave market. So the People's Crusade ended up being quite a fizzle. However, the Prince's Crusade, which is the other part of that first crusade, was a very much different deal. So what happens in the Prince's Crusade is you end up with very serious kind of top-tier level aristocrats gathering their personal retinues and heading to the Holy Land, or heading to Constantinople. Now, some of them were longtime enemies of Alex. So down here in Sicily, you had a guy by the name of Bohemond. He's descendant of the Normans, and yes, that is the same Normans who conquer England. But he and his family moved down to southern Italy and Sicily and set up a kingdom there. And he has been fighting with Alex Komnenos' army here in for control of various parts of the Balkan Peninsula. Well, when he hears the Pope say, hey, you can go fight against the Saracens and God will forgive all your sins, he thought, that sounds good, but isn't that Constantinople? Isn't that their territory? But sure, let's see what happens. Now, he knew good and well he was actually going to be sent over here. This is where the Holy Land is. But he kind of thought he'd take whatever he can get. So he marches his men over here, and Alex gets really spooked when he finds out who all's coming, because Bohemond's only one of them. There's some other guys. There's another one from up in here, the county of Count Raymond of Toulouse. He brings an army this way. There's an army that starts over in here. I can't remember the guy's name who's leading that, but you can see these are top-tier level military commanders with large armies, and they're coming to conquer. What's going on often is these aristocratic families, the second-born son wasn't going to inherit much, so he's the guy who would usually kind of get sent off on errands. And so these guys are going to be cut out of their inheritances back in Europe anyhow. They're not going to get much. Why don't we go down to the Middle East and see if we can conquer some new territory, set up a kingdom there, and be the king? So Alex recognizes this. He says, this is not good. So as soon as these guys come into his city, he brings the leaders up into his imperial palace. He has this very big throne set up. He tries to overawe them with kind of the glitz and glamour of the palace. And it is indeed Byzantine by this time, so it's very ornate. And he manages to make them all swear fealty to him. This really went down pretty hard with people like Bohemond. They didn't want to swear fealty to him, but they did because they were kind of stuck. He'd try to isolate them and keep them half-starved, and so that they needed him to supply them with food. And then as soon as they swore fealty, he'd get them food and send them on. So he very quickly moved them across the Bosphorus into Anatolia and was hoping that none of them would decide to stay and take over his city. It was a wise move because later we're going to find out that does actually happen in the Fourth Crusade. So this crusade is fantastically successful from the crusaders' perspective. So this is all happening I think it's in 1090. Well, there's kind of a stretch of time. Let's just say from about 1095 when he preaches to 1099 is sort of what you can think of as the time period of this crusade. But the actual fighting is compressed into the last 2 years of that, maybe. So they first have a battle over here about in the center of the Anatolian Peninsula. This is the capital city of those Seljuk Turks. It's ancient Iconium, modern-day Konya. They have this big battle, and they quickly rout the Turks. The Turks are not quite sure what they've got here. These are warriors who fight a little differently. They're more heavily armored, and when they charge, you don't want those guys getting close to you. These are true knights. They're couching their lances. They're riding heavy horses. And the Turks can handle them, but if they get caught where they can't escape, then fighting these guys hand-to-hand was really quite dangerous. So the Turks were a little bit disorganized, weren't able to figure out a way to defeat them, and kind of had to just move out of the way. So the Crusaders win that battle, and then they keep on marching. And by now, the Seljuk Turks, they're not super well organized, and so there's kind of a logistical supply and demand sort of problems. They're not sure how to get their armies where they need to go. It's kind of a common thing for steppe warriors to not be super good at these kinds of things if they're in a place that they're maybe isn't their homeland, and so that's kind of how they find themselves. The major action, I'm skipping a bunch. Let's just say a major siege that we should talk about is the Siege of Antioch. So there were some other things that went on before that, and at least one of these princes peeled off and started his own little place up in Edessa. He captured Edessa and said, okay, I'm done fighting. This is where I'm going to stay. The others all got their heads together and said, you guys are sticking through until we get all the way down to Jerusalem and free it. And so they don't let anybody else quite get out so easily. But the next major action is around Antioch. So they're trying to capture Antioch, and this ends up being a harder thing to do than they thought it would be. So it starts in 1097, is when the siege starts. It starts in October, and it ends in June of 1098. So it's almost a year-long siege. Now, this siege, it has some pretty weird pieces to it, so I'll try to give you the story as well as I can. It's a bit of a complicated story. What starts out is they surround the city, and the Muslims inside Antioch are just thinking, these guys are going to go away after a while, and pretty soon some help will come from other Seljuk armies, and we'll be fine. And that wasn't the case. Nobody was getting in or out. And pretty soon the people inside the city started getting hungry, and the besiegers start getting hungry too. Because the way siege warfare works is if you truly want to stay at one place and besiege it, it means that you're not able to bring in food from very far around. Because your guys have to stay here. So often, starving out a city often meant that the army besieging the city starved almost as badly as the city itself. And that's what goes on with these crusaders. They're getting really hungry. And they're desperate to find a way in. So finally, one of them, I think it was Bohemond, found a guy through his spy networks on the inside who would open the gates for him. And so he got this big meeting with the other crusader princes, and he said, look, guys, if we could just agree that whoever gets into the city first, we'll just give the city to them. You guys agree with that? And everybody, well, we're not in yet. Sure, that works. And Bohemond knew he has this guy that's already agreed to do that when he pays him. And so he said, okay, that's a deal. We'll see what we can do. So everybody go try as hard as you can to get in the city. Well, that night, he paid off his guy. His guy opens a gate. His men charge in. There's a lot of fighting, but they managed to open the big gates and let all the rest of the crusaders in. And it looks like the fall of Antioch has occurred. However, the citadel in the middle of Antioch. So most of these towns had a big wall, and then in the middle they had a stronghold called the citadel, and it was an extra strongly fortified place. That place didn't fall, but the rest of the city did. And so the crusaders are happy. They've captured the city, except for that one last little bastion in the middle. and they kind of settle in to celebrate their victory. And Bohemond is happy. Yeah, I get the city now. You know, I captured it. I got in first. Everybody else is like, that was a dirty trick. But they agree that that's what's going to happen. Well, about that time they hear rumors. There's an army coming to relieve Antioch. Well, sure enough, they look out and there is an army. And that army besieges them. So now you have the situation where in the very middle of Antioch, you have the stronghold with a few Muslim defenders in the middle. Then you have the crusader army who has conquered the city and the walls. They're the next layer of the onion. They close the gates. And out around is a big old Muslim army who's out to get the crusaders. This is turning into a really strange little siege. Eventually, a guy... some kind of monk, I don't remember his name, I think it might have been Peter, he claims that he found a fragment of the true cross buried in the dirt below, sorry, not the true cross, I think it was the spear that pierced Jesus' side, one of the two, some famous relic, buried in the place behind the altar in this old Antiochian church. And, oh, this got everybody excited, they grabbed the relic, and they said, this will work. We're going to take this and we're going to attack those Turks. So they threw open the gates of the city. They charge out on their horses. And the Turks didn't quite know what to make of this mad dash by these people who ought to be scared of them. Because there was a much bigger army out there than inside. But their kind of impetuosity and sort of ridiculous attack kind of had its effect. And the Turkish army wasn't particularly well led. It fell back in disarray. Finally, the Turks just turned and rode off, said, this isn't worth it. And the Christians looked around and said, God delivered us. He gave us the city by giving us this holy relic that led us to victory. And soon thereafter, the citadel in the middle of the city falls, and there are predictable massacres that go along at the same with all this conquest. So, Antioch falls. Only one very major objective left, and that is the little city of Jerusalem. So the crusaders managed to tell to browbeat Bohemond into not staying behind at Antioch like their other compatriot had in Edessa. So the Normans continue to march with them. Now, the Normans are a very important part of this army. They're a powerful military force. So they march on down to Jerusalem, and in 1099... the massive crusader army, and it is still it's a big army for European knights. And that army camps around Jerusalem, but Jerusalem is nowhere nearly as well defended as Antioch was. The fortifications aren't as significant, the leadership inside isn't as skilled, and there just isn't as much chance for Jerusalem to defend itself. So, after a couple of weeks, I think it's about 3 or 4 weeks if I remember right, they found a way to smash their way through a certain gate. There's some kind of single knight heroics to open up gates and die in battle and stuff like that. And they burst into the city, and what follows is just plain dreadful. Here in the city, the holy city where they were hoping to end their crusade, this is what happens according to one guy's account. So the man's name is Raymond of Aylor. He's a Frenchman. And this is what he has to say. But now that our men had possession of the walls and the towers, wonderful sights were to be seen. Some of our men, and this was more merciful, cut off the heads of their enemies. Others shot them with arrows, so they fell from the towers. Others tortured them longer by casting them into the flames. Piles of heads, hands, and feet were to be seen in the streets of the city. It was necessary to pick one's way over the bodies of men and horses, but these were small matters compared to what happened at the Temple of Solomon, a place where religious services are ordinarily chanted. What happened there? If I tell the truth, it will exceed your powers of belief. So let it suffice to say this much, at least, that in the temple and the porch of Solomon, men rode in blood up to their knees and bridle reins. Indeed, it was a just and splendid judgment of God that this place should be filled with the blood of unbelievers, since it had long suffered so since it had suffered so long from their blasphemies. The city was filled with corpses and blood. Some of the enemies took refuge in the Tower of David and, petitioning Count Raymond for protection, surrendered the tower into his hands. It is this massacre that most epitomizes the horror and the violence of the Crusades' impact on the Muslim population of the Holy Lands, Syria, Palestine, parts of Turkey. They just didn't know quite what to make of these Christians. For hundreds of years, these Muslims had lived there peacefully, and suddenly there was this kind of mailed invasion from the north, and these guys, they kill with abandon. They don't seem to have any mercy. They seem to hate all Muslims as wicked people, and these are Muslims who don't really know why. They're not particularly well-versed in the Christian religion. They don't know quite what's going on. So that's the end of the Prince's Crusade. So this Prince's Crusade really kind of is this huge, shocking moment for people along the fairly narrow slice of their route. Now, of course, there's a lot more to the Muslim Middle East, and those people are largely untouched by the Crusaders' attack on Jerusalem. Well, that was the first crusade. It successfully establishes a number of kingdoms. Here we go. So here you can see some of the kingdoms. The Kingdom of Jerusalem is here. That's set up. There's a Frankish ruler of that. The county of Tripoli. Oh, I'm missing it. County of Tripoli. Oh, here we go. County of Tripoli. The County of Edessa, that's this one, and the Princedom of Antioch, that's Bohemond. So you can see there are quite a number of little crusader statelets, you might call them, scattered around here. I think there are five total, maybe. Some of these are maybe occurring at slightly different times. But these statelets don't end up lasting particularly long. The first to fall, I think, was Edessa. I think it falls fairly quickly, and there was another crusade called, I think the second crusade was called to address that, didn't really work. And then a Muslim leader comes along, probably a once-in-a-generation talent. His name was Saladin, as we might know him. He's a Kurd from the mountains of Turkey. And he begins to lead his forces against these crusader states, kind of one by one. And it isn't long before he captures the kingdom of Jerusalem. So, well, he captures the city of Jerusalem. The city of Jerusalem is captured in 1187. So here we are about 87 years on, and the kingdom of Jerusalem has already fallen back to the Muslims. So, the third crusade is called for. The Pope gets all excited. We lost the kingdom of Jerusalem that we fought so hard for. Please come and help us. And three kings say, sure, we'll go. The king of France, the king of England, and the king of Germany. So, Richard the Lionheart is the king from England. He's actually more of a Frenchman than an Englishman. But he says, yeah, I'll go on crusade. He's young. And his great rival in France, Philip II, says he'll go. And Richard isn't all that excited about going if Philip doesn't go, because he's worried that if he goes, Philip is going to stay back home and capture some of England, or both are worried about the other one. So they decide to both go on crusade. And then Frederick Barbarossa, who is the German king, the Holy Roman Emperor, he decides to go as well. We'll bounce back to this slide. So this, actually, it doesn't give you a terribly good one. The third crusade is the red line. So it's showing the different kings' routes. I guess I might as well not draw, make it even messier by drawing on it. Notice the kings are coming kind of from different angles, but they're all trying to converge on the Holy Lands. Along the way, Barbarossa, right here, tries to cross a stream in armor, of all things. I don't know why he's wearing armor. He tries to cross the stream. His horse stumbles. He goes down. He can't swim because of his armor, and he drowns. One crusader king down. German army turns around and goes back. We're down to Philip and Richard the Lionheart. Philip II and Richard the Lionheart do get there together, and they do fight for a while, but they're very much at odds with each other. They don't really trust each other very much. So eventually, Philip decides to go back, and Richard says, I'm going to stay and fight. And Richard really did think he could take Jerusalem, but he finally realized he just can't beat Saladin, and so he gave up. So he went back home. Third Crusade ended with disaster, really. I mean, the kingdom of Jerusalem is in enemy hands, and nothing changed. But it's nowhere nearly as bad as the Fourth Crusade. The Fourth Crusade never gets to the Holy Land at all. Instead, it is turned loose on Constantinople. What happens is the Venetians don't like Constantinople very much because they're kind of trading enemies. And so the Venetians browbeat the crusaders that do come into attacking Constantinople instead of going on to the Holy Lands. And the crusaders do something that has never happened in the history of Constantinople. They crawl across the walls and through the gates and they sack the city. They attack the city and they take it by armed assault. This had never happened before. Nobody knew quite what to do about it. The crusaders kill the emperor and set up their own puppet emperor. It's called the Latin Empire. It doesn't last long, just a couple decades, and it's done. But it does create terrible havoc in Constantinople. The Byzantine Empire never will recover from this shock. It's going to kind of limp along for a little while yet. So this takes place in 1202. To 1204 is when the Fourth Crusade happens. And so the Byzantine Empire isn't going to go away until 1452 or 3. I don't remember which one. I'll tell you in the next lecture. So it does limp along for a while, but it has been dealt a mortal blow. However, what has happened to the rest of those Crusader states? Well, in 1291... the last remnant of the Crusader states finally falls into Muslim hands with the Mamluk capture of the stronghold of Acre. So, to kind of sum it up, the Crusades were sort of a voluntary mass migration of people from Europe into the Holy Lands over the span of time from roughly 1095 to 1291. And during that time, they established maybe five different little statelets, created countless massacres, were massacred in turn by Turks. In general, they were spectacularly unsuccessful in the long term. Few lasting physical or political changes remain from this era. But in the psyche of both Christian and Muslims, these wars continue to shape events down to the present day. Especially among Middle Eastern Muslims, the Crusades stand as a stark reminder of what to expect from the Kingdom of Christ. The next Muslim superpower would take decisive steps to protect itself from future Christian aggression. Okay, we're going to stop there and take a 5-minute... We can do more. Let's take a 10-minute break. Try to come in just a little bit before 7 o'clock. And that I'm using it as the people of the time would use it. They define themselves as Christians. They believe they were Christians. Regardless of how we may appraise their actions, they considered themselves Christians. So that's why I'm using the term. Now, obviously, we have very serious problems with some of their actions. So I'm not in any way attempting to claim that they really fit into the category of brothers in Christ. I'm simply using the term as they would have understood it. But before we get started with this next one, were there any questions from the last session? I didn't open it up for questions. Do you have any now? Go ahead. The different kings?
Yes.
Okay. Right. That's what everybody's afraid of. But do understand that it's not quite as easy as thinking of swearing in the same way that moderns think about it, because they did have a little bit more of a fear of what would happen to them. So it's not quite as simple as that, although Yes, when people swore fealty, everybody was a little concerned, is he going to actually hold up his end of the bargain? And of course, that is what happened. The story is far more complex than I made it. We left out a bunch. There's some really interesting stuff that happens around Nicaea, where the emperor actually... Anyhow, I'm not going to tell the story now. If you want it later, I happily give you more information. But yes, the problem is the swearing fealty. That's a really... It feels like a low bar for commanding obedience. And it was in this case. Yes? So by that time, there were very few Jews in Jerusalem. Jews had not been present in Jerusalem for... by that time, about 1,000 years. So the natives of Jerusalem for most of the Roman period are the kind of the natives of Palestine in general, sort of I guess you might call them Palestinians, but it's before that term was a thing, but the people of Palestine. So a lot of them were of Aramean or Arab descent, even many of them were Christians. When the Muslims conquered, they conquered a bunch of Arab Christians and stuff like that. So that population stayed there for a couple hundred years and then slowly started to convert to Islam during that Islamic Golden Age. So there were some Christians and some Jews, but not very many. Most of them would have been Muslim. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Yes. Ah, yes. Swearing an oath of allegiance and that you would obey the king's command, essentially. Fealty, it's driven more by honor, and honor mattered more to them than it probably does to us. Yes?
So the Celtic Church there in Anatolia, what happened to them?
Okay, yes. We're going to get into that in this lecture, so I'll tell you more about them. Briefly, at least. Okay, so let's get started with the Ottomans. So there's this hadith. Remember, the hadith are the sayings of the prophet. They're not quite the same thing as the Quran. There's this hadith that says this. Verily, you shall conquer Constantinople. What a wonderful leader will he be, and what a wonderful army will that army be. The Islamic world had waited more than 800 years for the capture of the great city, and always the Christians had managed to defend the walls and deny the Muslims a final prize. But that was about to change. So Muhammad himself had thought that, you know, soon they would be able to conquer Constantinople. That was considered kind of the normal prize. Constantinople, of course, the Persian Empire, you just take it all. And I think Muslims were very surprised that it had taken this long. They got pretty close earlier. They thought surely they would be able to, and it just never had quite come together. So what we need to do a little catch-up on the history. You'll notice over here that we have jumped forward another maybe couple hundred years. We're now looking, so we've seen... so far, we've looked at three of our five stories. The three stories have been the Constantine moment, when Christianity goes statewide, goes political, I guess. We looked at the birth of Islam. And now we've also seen the Crusades, the conflict between Christianity and the Islamic world in kind of the most bloody encounter yet. Now we're going to jump forward and look at what happens when the Turks finally capture Constantinople. This is also going to be a very significant event. So let's tell a little bit of the story of the Ottomans. They're kind of an interesting group. This is shows you the growth of them. So remember, the Seljuk Turks had conquered this area here in the center of Anatolia. They had set up their capital around Iconium, and for a while they were pretty content there, but other groups of Turks kept migrating in from the steppe regions and brought, you know, kind of new, rawer forms of Islam with them. But eventually, here in this little corner of the Seljuk area, a warlord by the name of Osman started to carve out some territory for himself. Now, he is right on the edge between Byzantine territory and Seljuk territory. He's kind of allied with the Seljuks. The Seljuks are fine with him. He's a Turk, after all, but he's like all those they call them martyr lords. The leaders on the frontiers are always a little bit hard to control because, well, they control land right up against the enemies. And he's one of those. He's hard to control. And he will sometimes fight against the Seljuks if he doesn't like what they're trying to do. And so he tends to want to fight against the Byzantine Empire because they're not Muslim, and he's most successful there. And so he carves out this little kind of princedom, as it were, little territory. And his warriors became known as Osmanlı, which is the Ottoman with Osman kind of term. I'm with him. Well, this term gets kind of anglicized over time, and eventually, in English, we're going to call them the Ottoman Turks. Now, Turks would call them the Osmanlı, and other people kind of have a slightly different term. But this is the beginning of the of the Ottoman Turks. So this is in 1300 or 1299. Some people say 1299, 1300, somewhere around there. That's when he gets started. The growth of the Ottomans is generational. It's slow. But every sultan that comes along adds another piece to the territory, and it starts just growing. And you just can't stop these guys. Every new sultan, he goes out on campaign every year usually. There's kind of constant fighting around him. And eventually he captures another city or another village, and the territory grows, and every sultan wants to capture more because that gives him greater honor. And as their territory grows, they become more of a threat. So you can see how this works. I'm not going to talk about colors because I discovered that I know nothing about colors. Now that I have children, I realize that if I say a color, it's the opposite of that color is the actual one. So this color is Osman's conquests, and this next one happens between 1300 and 1359. So by now they've got this bigger area they're controlling. And then between 1359 and 1451, a large amount of territory is added. You can see how they've already crossed the Aegean Sea here, they've crossed the Dardanelles, and they're over here in Europe. However, what you should notice is this little city of Constantinople is still standing. Now, it's labeled Istanbul here. That's a modern term. The Constantinople doesn't go through an official name change until well after the Ottomans capture it. So, they're conquering all the area around, all the Byzantine area around Constantinople, and they're doing it slowly over generations. Each sultan is contributing to this. It looked like they were going to conquer Constantinople sooner than they did, but the city got kind of a break when the Mongols, under Timur the Lame, or Tamerlane, kind of a distant Mongol relative, rolled through and captured Bayezid and an Ottoman sultan, and that really set back the Ottoman conquest for quite a little while. So that's going on at this end of the Mediterranean. So this is that period of time from about 1300 to 1450s. Let's take a look at the other end of the Mediterranean, or maybe just the whole setting here. So this is the setting of Europe just on the cusp of the fall of Constantinople. All right, so one of the important things you should note is over in Spain, a new thing is going on over here. The Christians have been pushing into Spain from the north and driving the Muslims south every generation. They're doing kind of the same thing that the Ottomans are doing at the other end of the Mediterranean. It's called the Reconquista, and this is the Spanish urge to fight back and to drive the Moors out of Spain and turn Spain into a Christian place once more. So that's going on over there. The Italian city-states right in here are starting to reap the gradual encirclement of Constantinople. They're starting to reap the rewards of that. So what's going on here in the Balkan territories that had once been Byzantine? As the Ottomans keep taking piece by piece these territories, scholars of Greek, speaking Greek and understanding the Greek language and having a lot of Greek manuscripts with them, scholars leave this area and they migrate to the wealthy states over here in the north of Italy. So this is happening in the kind of the first part of the 1400s. This is one of the reasons the Italian Renaissance is going on. So when you talk about the Renaissance, a driving force there is the importation of Greek learning and Greek manuscripts from these scholars fleeing the gradual Ottoman conquest of Byzantium. So the West suddenly starts to encounter learning that they had kind of lost track of in the East. So you've got the you've got this kind of rebirth of knowledge happening in northern Italy. You've got the gradual Ottoman takeover of the Byzantine Empire. You've got the Reconquista going on in Spain. Up here in France, France and England are forevermore fighting. It's over 100 years war going on up there. Eventually it does get fixed, but not for a long time. So, the situation when Mehmet II becomes a sultan is the embattled city of Constantinople is completely surrounded by Ottoman Empire, and Mehmet is this young sultan in his 20s, and he's determined to be the one that that hadith was written about, the guy who takes the city finally. Now, Constantinople has been through a lot of sieges. And it's a hard place to take. Now, the Latin kingdom showed that, you know, it was possible to take it by assault. But we're back to this picture. This is as zoomed in as you can get, kind of. And the Byzantine Empire has basically shrunk to this picture. There's not much else left. The last emperor of Constantinople is a guy by the name of Leo. And he's... Constantine, sorry, got the wrong guy. A guy by the name of Constantine, it's Constantine the 11th, so there have been a lot of Constantines. He's doing all the things. He's got the chain across the Golden Horn, he's been shoring up the Theodosian land walls, he's been making sure these sea walls are intact, but there aren't very many people in the walls. He doesn't have a big army at all. How in the world is he going to defend all those miles upon miles of walls when he doesn't have enough men? So he makes a last desperate plea. Please, he's sending this out into the Christian kingdom, back to the Catholic, Roman Catholic lands. Please come send help. Not too much response. There are a few. Some Venetians actually show up, interestingly enough. A couple of other groups show up from closer, like I think in Wallachia some groups come. But everybody kind of knows this is sort of the end. There's just really no way to keep those Ottomans out. They have become so powerful. Now, they're no longer the wild Turkic nomads from the steppes. They've become an incredibly sophisticated fighting machine. They've been fighting for generations here in Europe and Asia. They have figured out ways to use their money wisely, and they can hire the best weaponeers around. This is one of the first armies to invest heavily in gunpowder weapons. The Ottomans are sort of the cutting edge of the cannon revolution and the personal firearm revolution. They've got slave soldiers with aquabuses and the big Turkish bows, and they've got huge cannons. We'll take a peek at those later. There they are. And these cannons are immense. Some of them are shooting, you know, stone balls that are so big it takes several men to hoist them into position, or sometimes, you know, small cranes to lift them into positions. And when these balls hit the wall, they destroy it. I mean, these walls can't handle this kind of modern firepower. So, as they kind of wait for the end, the emperor and his people gear up for a last stand, and they are intending to defend the walls to the last man. You might ask why. Well, the why is because they're Christians. And those guys out there are the infidels. They're Muslims. They're the enemies of God. What else can we do but fight them? That's how we always have been dealing with the with our enemies. We fight them. And so Constantine the 11th and his army wait. But it doesn't take long. The Ottomans they know their history, and they know kind of how to deal with this. So they're geared up, ready for Greek fire. They sail their... They actually, because they own the land all the way around Constantinople, they don't have to sail up this way. They bring their ships down from the north, and they land them right here. They put them on rollers, roll them across, and splash into the Golden Horn. They just ignore this chain here, and they get their ships in the guarded sanctuary. And there's a couple nasty sea battles, and then there is no Byzantine navy left. Now you've got the Ottomans surrounding the city. They've got ships in the Golden Horn. They've got ships out here. They've got a land army out here. There is no way to keep them out anymore. They've got those huge cannons, and they've got a huge army. So in 1453 is when Mehmet kind of unleashes this whole campaign. And after a lengthy siege, it's a couple of months if I'm remembering correctly, he decides it's time now. Now, what he had done to make so his army could endure that long of a siege, he had actually brought seeds in. He had in this area out around, he had planted fields so that his men would have food through that long siege. That's the kind of planning that's going into this. He is not going anywhere until he gets that city. So, he turns loose his cannons, batters the walls, but the walls keep getting repaired. They've filled in behind the walls with dirt. There's kind of back and forth. There's some tunneling and counter-tunneling. There's a fight going on here. They're not giving up easily. But he's got the Janissaries, too. And the Janissaries are the slave soldiers. So he would tax his Christians one boy per so many households. So if a village had 10 households, they might have to give up two boys every time the defshirme is levied, this tax. And these Christian boys would be taken. They're young. They're under 10 years old. They're taken to an Islamic school. They're taught the tenets of Islam. They're raised as the Sultan's own slaves, and they become fanatically devoted to him, fanatical Muslims. And these guys have the opportunity to rise very high in the government. And their families know that. So there are even times when their families are kind of okay with these boys being taken, because they know that they're going to become wealthy, and then maybe that would trickle back to their family. So they'd have somebody in high government position. But in many cases, people are just devastated when their sons are taken. So there's a little bit of a mixed feeling here. But this Janissary Corps becomes this super elite infantry battalion that, when they're turned loose, things are bad, because they don't stop coming until you kill them. They're incredibly dangerous. Very organized, very well trained, and very devoted to the Sultan. So, as the assault proceeds, he starts his assault one night. Wave after wave of attackers hit the walls. They're hitting kind of all along the wall, just waiting for a weak point to happen. And they keep getting beaten back by the defenders on the walls. And finally, a breach is kind of made. There's a group that kind of fights through the walls and manages to create a little bit of space. As soon as he sees that, Mehmet II sends in his Janissaries into that breach. And they hit like kind of a tidal wave, and they just sort of push everybody back. And that creates the initial breachhead. And from then on, the army just keeps coming. And at some point, there's no way to stop. Everybody knows it's over. Constantine the 10th, we're not quite sure. There are two different accounts of how he ends it. But just before, on the eve of the battle, just to give you a sense for how he feels about this, on the eve of the battle, he attends Vespers. It's a special evening ceremony in the great church of Hagia Sophia. This is the kind of the center of Byzantine Christianity. And he's got people from both the Eastern Orthodox Church, which is the Patriarch of Constantinople, and from the Roman Catholic Church. They're together holding this last Mass. They know the assault is coming tonight. They're having this last mass together. Even though they have excommunicated each other, they're coming back together. The church is whole again. And Constantine is there. Midnight of that night is when the assault comes. By morning, it's pretty much over. Constantine, we think, takes off his robe, grabs a sword, and plunges into the last melee, and nobody finds his body. That's one story. Another story says that he went off somewhere and hanged himself. We're not sure which, but he died during the attack on Constantinople. And Constantinople is taken. The city that has for so long kind of been seen as the eastern bulwark against the Muslims, it's now a Muslim city. So Mehmet, he's ecstatic. He's got his goal finally. He's known forever as Mehmet the Conqueror. He quickly sets about repairing the walls. He builds a new palace. He builds hospitals. He builds barracks for the Janissaries. He lures Christians and Muslims into the city by giving them tax breaks and stuff like that. He wants to make this a big city. Now that he's attacked it and conquered it, he wants it to make it even better. The Hagia Sophia, that church that had seen, you know, Constantine just moments before, it now gets turned into a mosque. Incidentally, if you want to see that church, you can still go to Istanbul in Turkey and walk in the church and see it. It's still there. It's been there for 1,500 years, and unless an earthquake hits, it's probably going to stay for a little while yet. The dome did fall in during one earthquake, but they put it back up. That was fairly early on in its history. So Mehmet the Conqueror, he's done it. He's reached the pinnacle of his ambition. But Christians throughout Europe feel very differently. So Muslim Turks, they're going to threaten Europe with outright conquest for centuries to come. But their high watermark kind of comes in the 1500s. They don't, after the 1500s, they're not a serious threat. So, but they do frighten Europe very badly. Eventually, let's see, do I have, yes, here we go. Well, let's kind of follow their path here. Here you can see that the ultimate conquests go deep into Poland and Hungary. They threaten Vienna itself. Here's Vienna. Vienna is kind of seen as sort of a capital of Europe in some ways. It's the capital of the Holy Roman Empire often, not always, but often it is. And it's a cultural center for Christianity in Europe. And to have the Ottoman front lines so close to them was terrifying. These are the people who took the holy city, Constantinople, and now they're about to take Vienna. And they try. Mehmet the Conqueror's grandson, Suleiman, nearly takes Vienna. He besieges it, and they fight him off, and he kind of retreats in some chaos. Before that, he had fought the king of Hungary and killed him. So this Christian king of Hungary has just been killed. There is no bigger, more dangerous enemy to European Christendom than the Turks. The Turks are the big, bad, scary people. So I want to now kind of pull back from this and think just a little bit, how should Christians feel about this? What do we do about, you know, the Ottoman threat? Should we do what the Christians did and fight back, or is there a better option? Well, interestingly, from our tradition, we have kind of a fascinating intersection of how someone who believes much like we do was in a position to comment on this. So we're going to take a look at Michael Sattler. So Michael Sattler is this well-known Anabaptist. He's on trial in 1527 in southern Germany. So think right around in here somewhere. Really not that far from the front lines. So just 2 years before his trial, the Ottoman Turks had destroyed this Hungarian army, had killed the king, And now he's on trial, and those Turks are just out there. I mean, they're not far away. And all of Christendom is worried about them. But if you know anything about your history, know that in 1527, we're about 10 years into a new thing in Europe, at least in Europe Christendom. This is the Protestant Reformation. It's just starting right now. 1517 is when Martin Luther nails his 95 theses to the door at Wittenberg. It starts kind of this entire movement happening. And as kind of a spinoff of this, or a branch of this movement, are the Anabaptists coming along and saying, oh, Martin Luther and Zwingli, you are not going nearly far enough. We want to go a lot farther away than what you're talking about. We want to go back to that time when Christianity was not connected at all to state power. We want to go way back there. Well, Luther, all he really wanted to do was kind of sever ties with the Pope and set up a little bit more theologically satisfying kind of religion that's still state, largely state, or connected to the state. Zwingli also wanted that. Calvin is going to move a little bit from that, but he's also quite comfortable with that kind of thing. So the Anabaptists are quite extreme in their take on what should happen. And they are, of course, going to have a different kind of way of thinking about what do we do with these enemies right here, these Turks. So Michael Sattler had been preaching. He had been a leader in the Anabaptist movement for some time. There had been quite a number of churches and believers started under him. And he got captured by the Catholic authorities, not the Protestant authorities. Gets captured by these Catholic authorities, put on trial. Now, I'm going to read a lengthy section here from the Global Anabaptist Encyclopedia. And I just do it because they do a good job of kind of condensing the story in a way that you can understand. They're pulling from primary sources. It's just not my words, it's their words. I'm breaking into the middle of this trial. He's kind of been holding his own. They've been trying to convince him that he's wrong, and he's been trying to convince them that they're wrong, and nobody's really been getting anywhere, scoring any points, really, except he's been kind of keeping up his end. And these are very powerful Catholic officials. They're much higher in rank than Michael is. Concerning the last point, Sattler admitted that he had taught that if the Turks should come, no armed resistance should be made, for it is written, thou shalt not kill. Whoa, that's the enemy he's talking about. He's saying, if the Turks come here, we shouldn't be fighting them. This is overturning a millennia or more of Christian thinking. For it is written, thou shalt not kill. We should not resist any of our persecutors with the sword, but with prayer cling to God that he might resist and defend. Sattler even admitted, having said that if war were right, he would rather march against supposed Christians who persecute, capture, and kill the God-fearing. The Turk knows nothing about the Christian faith. He's a Turk, according to the flesh. But you want to be considered Christians, and you boast of being Christ's, and still persecute his pious witnesses. You are Turks, according to the Spirit. To this strong admonition to the conscience of the court, Sattler added in conclusion that it was their calling to punish the wicked and protect the good. He could bear witness that the Anabaptists had done nothing contrary to God and the gospel. Likewise, the closest examination would substantiate that he and his brethren had never opposed the government by any act or word, either in revolt or sedition, nor in any other way. He demanded that experts be called and the Bible used in the original languages. A debate should be arranged. The Anabaptists were ready to be taught from the Bible. If they were proved to be in error, they would gladly bear the punishment. But if we are not shown to be in error, I hope to God that you will accept teaching and be converted. The idea that the judges might be taught and converted by Sattler seemed so peculiar to them that they put their heads together and burst out laughing. This is kind of his death knell. He gets in their faces and basically says, the Turks are just doing what they should be, but you guys are Christians and you should be doing better. I'd rather fight for them if fighting were right. I'd rather be on their side than yours. Well, that's clearly the end of the story for him. And they did sentence him to death He was tried and he was executed soon thereafter for his faith. That's how the Anabaptists viewed the Turks. It's a little different from the story that the rest of the Christendom was preaching, isn't it? I think it's closer to what the early Christians probably would have said. Michael Sadler understood something about the kingdom of God that most of the people who have featured in our story so far did not understand. He realized that conquering a physical kingdom would have no effect on the kingdom of God. Way back in the 600s, Muhammad had predicted that his religion would conquer Constantinople. He saw this as the final defeat of Christianity. But as Michael understood, the kingdom of God was something very different from the Byzantine Empire. Jesus' kingdom does not need to be defended. Instead, it needs to be tended. But Christians have had a hard time learning this lesson. And in our next session, they will once more attempt to force change on the Muslim population of the Middle East. We'll be talking about the time of the two world wars and kind of the setting up of the modern Middle East. And that'll be our first session tomorrow morning. I'm wondering if you have some questions. Okay, let's pray. Father, thank you for the chance to